Welcome to the debate. Imagine you are piloting a commercial airliner. You look down at the console, and instead of, you know, a complex panel showing your exact altitude, fuel levels, and engine temperature, there's just a single giant dial right in the center of the dashboard, and it reads flight score, 85.
That sounds absolutely terrifying. I mean, I wouldn't want to be anywhere near that plane.
Right. Because the right engine could literally be on fire, but because the cabin pressure is perfect and the passengers are watching movies and you have a strong tailwind, the aggregate score just averages out to a solid B+.
Yeah, it hides the disaster.
Exactly. You think you are flying safely right up until the exact moment you crash.
I actually love that analogy. But I mean, if we extend it, what happens if you replace that single oversimplified dial with a dashboard of, say, 500 flashing lights? All of them are red. All of them are screaming for attention. But the console comes with absolutely no manual telling you which one is going to kill you first.
Okay. I see where you're going.
Right, because the plane still goes down. It just goes down with a much more overwhelmed pilot.
Well, that tension between the danger of oversimplification and the risk of overwhelming complexity is exactly what brings us to today's focal point. We are looking at Dr. Bechara Sahali's paper, Indicators of Life Coherent Peace, which was published on May 8, 2026.
Yeah, and it's quite a read.
It really is. The paper proposes a, frankly, radical shift away from how we currently measure societal progress. It essentially argues that we need to completely abandon single-score metrics in favor of this multidimensional life coherence dashboard.
Right. And so the central question we are exploring today is whether rejecting a single commensurable score, where, you know, everything can just be mathematically averaged, in favor of this highly complex 10-domain dashboard actually protects human and ecological life, or if its sheer complexity inevitably invites administrative paralysis.
My stance is that this multidimensional dashboard is a rigorous, absolutely necessary evolution. I think it finally exposes the hidden structural violence in our systems by measuring what actually sustains life rather than just, you know, what is merely easy for a spreadsheet to count.
And my position is that while the framework offers a brilliant, honestly, almost flawless critique of our current metrics, its complete rejection of commensurability is dangerous.
How so?
Well, its refusal to let us weigh one priority mathematically against another, combined with these massive administrative requirements, just makes it highly vulnerable to institutional collapse.
Let's lay the groundwork, then, by looking at the specific disease this paper is trying to cure. The fundamental premise of Dr. Sahali's paper is that our traditional metrics, things like GDP or even aggregate well-being indexes, suffer from what the text calls life blindness. They create this illusion of false commensurability.
And just to clarify, commensurability being the idea that you can neatly swap one thing for another on a balance sheet.
Exactly. In a single score system, if a corporation, say, destroys an ancient sacred ecological site to build a massive factory, that profound loss can literally be offset on paper by rising local incomes or new infrastructure.
Right. The line goes up, so we call it progress.
Yeah. The metric treats non-substitutable life capacities as if they are just tradable commodities. So to cure this, the paper demands a dashboard with 10 distinct domains. We are talking about tracking basic life necessities and health, all the way to more complex societal needs, like what it calls felt being and cultural linguistic worlds.
And it doesn't even stop there. Within each of those 10 domains, public institutions would have to track 5 specific types of indicators.
Right. Signal, threshold, distribution, narrative, and repair. And I think it's worth explaining how these actually work together, because it's not just some random list of buzzwords.
Go for it.
So a signal indicator might just tell you water levels in a local aquifer are dropping. Simple enough. But a threshold indicator establishes the absolute red line. Like, if the water drops another inch, the aquifer permanently collapses.
Okay.
Then, distribution tracks exactly who is losing their water first. Narrative measures how that water loss is actually impacting the community's daily lived experience. And finally, repair tracks what the institution is doing to actively fix the harm.
It's thorough, I'll give it that.
It is. By insisting on this specific, layered tracking, the framework accurately maps the reality of life. It completely refuses to let a rising average hide a localized disaster.
Look, the ambition is incredible, and I fully acknowledge the immense moral weight of what this paper is trying to achieve. The critique of life blindness is profound. But, and this is a big but, we have to look at the applied viability of this framework.
Okay, fair.
Public institutions, by their very nature, exist to allocate finite resources under intense pressure.
True, but those resources shouldn't be allocated blindly.
No, they absolutely shouldn't. But by insisting that all 10 dimensions must be equally visible, and more importantly, that none of them can be compressed or traded off against one another, this framework risks a catastrophic level of administrative burden.
You think it's too much for them to handle?
I do. If you give a local government a dashboard with 10 domains and 5 indicator types per domain, and absolutely no mathematical mechanism to weigh competing priorities, they are going to freeze. Or worse, you are going to get what the text itself fears, which is technocratic capture.
Wait, why is technocratic capture the default fear here? Technocrats love simple math, right? Not complex, multidimensional dashboards?
Because overwhelmed agencies don't just magically rise to the occasion when you hand them more paperwork. Technocratic capture happens when the tool designed to track a complex reality gets hijacked by bureaucrats who just figure out the easiest way to check the boxes.
Just to keep their funding?
Exactly. They completely ignore the spirit of the rule. They will quietly default to whatever's easiest to count or whatever keeps them out of legal trouble. And suddenly, the whole revolutionary dashboard just becomes another compliance checklist.
Well, I completely disagree that it inevitably becomes a checklist, because the framework is specifically designed to force a confrontation with reality.
How?
Let's take this out of the abstract and look at a real-world collision. The paper gives us a phenomenal case study to test this, the forest displacement scenario.
Ah, right. This is the scenario with the refugees and the sacred forest.
Exactly. So, you have a displaced population urgently in need of shelter, food, and sanitation, but the only apparently available land for an emergency camp is an ancient forest that sustains high biodiversity, critical watershed functions, and serves as an irreplaceable sacred site for indigenous communities.
A tragic choice.
Exactly. Now, under a traditional cost-benefit analysis, you would just crunch the numbers. You'd assign a monetary value to the timber, estimate the cost of the, ecosystem services, weigh it against the financial cost of alternative housing, and spit out a decision. You'd probably bulldoze the forest, because it's mathematically cheaper.
Which is a terrible outcome, I fully agree.
Right. The dashboard succeeds precisely because it forces a red line analysis instead of a math equation. It operates like a doctor checking your vital signs individually. You cannot offset a failing liver with a strong pulse.
Yeah, I see the parallel.
In the same way, you cannot offset the permanent erasure of a culture with a temporary provision of emergency tents. The dashboard flashes red for the forest, forcing the institution to look for another way.
That is a very elegant way to frame it. But let's actually play out what happens when you hit red lines on both sides of that dashboard. Because in that exact forest displacement scenario, the dashboard identifies non-substitutable thresholds for the displaced families too, right?
Yes, of course. Imminent risk to human life.
Right. Disease, exposure, death. And it also identifies non-substitutable thresholds for the forest, irreversible ecological collapse, and cultural severance.
Yes, the conflict is the point.
But if both are non-substitutable and neither can be subordinated to the other, the dashboard essentially freezes action. Doesn't this absolute refusal to establish a hierarchy of values leave decision makers completely without a compass?
I wouldn't call it freezing action.
It's like having a GPS that tells you, don't turn left, don't turn right, don't go forward, and don't stop. When tragedy forces a choice, standing paralyzed in the name of non-commensurality potentially causes the exact life disablement the system was built to prevent. The displaced families suffer while the dashboard just blinks red.
Okay, but you are assuming that a compass has to be a calculator that just picks a winner and a loser. The paper explicitly states that the framework does not eliminate conflict, it changes how we arbitrate it.
Okay, tell me how.
When you hit two colliding red lines, the dashboard forces the institution to seek the least life-destroying path through what it calls the interpretation cycle. It stops the contractor from just bulldozing the forest because it happens to be the easiest option.
Sure.
It forces emergency powers to have sunset clauses. It forces a transparent assessment of degraded land alternatives. Maybe there's land further away that requires busing, which costs more money, but preserves the life ground. The friction you are calling paralysis is actually the system working.
The system working by slowing everything down?
Yes. It is preventing an irreversible harm from being quietly justified as an administrative necessity. We are so used to structural violence where policies slowly crush people or environments without a single person ever pulling a trigger that we view any delay in the bureaucracy as a failure.
But look at what that friction actually entails in practice. How does the framework say we resolve this gridlock? It brings us to the dashboard's interpretation cycle, specifically the requirement to, quote, interpret with affected communities.
Which is essential.
But because there is no mathematical formula, the entire framework places the massive burden of resolution entirely on participatory dialogue.
And that right there is the ultimate safeguard against data colonialism.
Meaning what, exactly?
That outside consultants can't just fly in, extract data, and dictate terms?
Exactly. Data colonialism is when a centralized authority, or, you know, a corporation, drops into a vulnerable area, extracts the numbers they deem valuable, and uses that data to govern the community without their actual input.
They come in with the answers already decided.
Right. They claim to know what the community needs based on a spreadsheet, entirely bypassing the lived reality of the people there. By forcing participatory dialogue, the dashboard blocks that extraction. The community has to validate the data. In theory, avoiding data colonialism is fantastic. But let's look at the institutional reality here. The text warns us directly about institutional self-protection and depoliticization. Requiring exhaustive narrative mapping and participatory consensus for every major infrastructure or emergency decision just provides entrenched power with endless opportunities to delay.
If you have an urgent humanitarian crisis, can you really pause to gather narrative indicators on felt being and relational legitimacy?
Gathering narrative indicators isn't a luxury you skip when things get tough. It is the only way to know if your intervention is actually working.
Is it?
Look at the Water Commons example in the text. A traditional water utility measures revenue recovery and, I don't know, maybe gallons delivered. They see a high payment rate and they think the system is perfectly healthy.
Sure, they see success on paper, but the dashboard forces them to measure narrative indicators. Things like the profound shame, the household stress, and the fear generated by the constant threat of water shutoffs.
I don't disagree that measuring the shame of a water shutoff reveals a deeper truth about structural violence. It's a genuinely great insight. But how does a city actually measure felt being?
By asking them.
But felt being isn't a heart rate. It's asking a single mother how stressed she is about her water bill. Mapping lived experiences of psychosocial security across an entire municipal population requires a level of state capacity that most local governments simply do not possess.
Dr. Saley attempts to solve this exact capacity issue by proposing a tiered dashboard. There's a minimum, expanded, and full version. The local water board doesn't have to run a 10-year psychological study.
But even the minimum dashboard requires tracking distribution of burden and ecological risk. Let's be real about municipal budgets here. A chronically underfunded local water board is not going to effectively implement a phenomenological study of community shame while simultaneously tracking aquifer depletion rates and trying to replace lead pipes.
So what do you think happens?
They will outsource this to consultants. It becomes a multi-million dollar narrative study, farmed out to a big accounting firm, and we are right back to technocratic capture.
I think you are underestimating the capacity of communities to articulate their own realities. The paper isn't suggesting that the water board hire an army of phenomenologists to go knock on doors.
Then who does it?
It's suggesting they stop treating residents as delinquent customers and start treating them as rights-bearing participants. When a community maps its own narrative indicators through local councils, public grievance logs, or participatory budgeting, it doesn't require a massive state apparatus. It requires a relinquishment of top-down control.
Which institutions notoriously hate doing.
True. Which is exactly why the framework's ultimate safety net is its recursive repair cycle. If the participatory process is messy, or if the institution tries to game the system, the dashboard forces a mechanism of correction.
Ah, the recursive repair cycle. This is where I think the framework crosses from ambitious into genuinely utopian.
Really? Why? I find the repair indicators to be the most groundbreaking feature of the entire dashboard. Think about how measurement usually works right now. It's essentially just a status update.
A snapshot in time.
Yeah. A report gets published, we all look at the graph, we see that inequality got worse, we wring our hands, and the report goes on a shelf until next year. The measurement itself does absolutely nothing to fix the problem.
Right. It's just an observation.
Exactly. But this dashboard introduces repair indicators. We are talking about tracking grievance resolution time, specific funding allocated for ecological restoration, and even public apologies. It demands that measurement triggers immediate restitution. It transforms the dashboard from a static diagnostic tool into an active accountability mechanism.
You are assuming that repair can be quantified without being immediately corrupted.
How do you mean?
You are trying to put a metric on a moral act. And ironically, gaming the metrics is another specific risk identified in the text itself.
Okay, but how do you game a metric like ecological restoration funds secured?
By turning it into a cost of doing business. If a bureaucratic institution or corporation is told it must hit targets for restoration funds secured or grievances processed, what do you think will happen?
They'll have to pay it.
They will transform the profound moral act of repair into a bureaucratic checklist. It's like putting a number of apologies per week quota on a toxic marriage. The abuser will just say, "I'm sorry," 5 times on Monday morning and think they've met the standard.
Well, that's a bit cynical.
A corporation will pay the fines, process the grievances through an automated AI chatbot, issue a templated public apology written by PR consultants, and then continue the exact same life-disabling activities. You simply cannot metricize contrition.
I hear that. But think about what happens when you measure the friction of that process. A metric like grievance resolution time isn't supposed to measure literal heartfelt contrition. It's supposed to measure institutional friction.
Friction again.
Yes. If it takes 3 years for a community to get a response about a toxic spill, that is a verifiable, undeniable metric of relational domination. By forcing that data into the dashboard, you make the delay visible. You make the structural violence undeniable.
But making it undeniable doesn't automatically fix it.
No, but it gives the community leverage. Furthermore, you aren't just tracking the processing of the grievance. Under the value sequence and institutional accountability domain, which is domain 10 of the dashboard, you are specifically tracking whether the institution is subordinating money and administration to life.
Right, domain 10.
You track who pays, who profits, who bears the risk. An automated PR apology doesn't satisfy domain 10 if the profit structure hasn't fundamentally changed. You are auditing the power structure itself.
Which brings me right back to my point about administrative paralysis. Let's stack this all up and look at the sheer weight of what we are asking a local council to do.
Okay.
To build a simple new housing development, they must now track basic necessities, health, sense-making, felt being, agency, relational legitimacy, universal access, ecological life ground, cultural linguistic worlds, and institutional accountability.
Yes. Because housing impacts all of those things.
I don't deny that it does. But they must use signal, threshold, distribution, narrative, and repair indicators for each of those 10 domains. They must co-define all of this with the affected communities to avoid data colonialism. They must establish non-substitutable red lines for everything. I have to ask again, how does anything ever actually get built?
You're still prioritizing speed.
The paper warns that life disablement is often justified as efficiency. But at a certain point, basic efficiency is required to actually deliver the means of life. If we can't build the housing, people stay on the streets.
we have normalized a very specific, highly destructive definition of efficiency. Yes, bypassing indigenous sovereignty and ignoring watershed thresholds makes a construction project move a lot faster. But that is only efficient if you just don't count the cost of the destroyed culture and the poisoned water.
That's a strong point.
The dashboard slows things down because avoiding irreversible harm takes time. If the price of preventing structural violence is a slower administrative process, that is a price a life-coherent society must be willing to pay.
But time is a life capacity, too. In the forest displacement example, every single day, the dashboard's interpretation cycle delays the construction of shelter is a day displaced families spend exposed to the elements, to disease, to trauma.
I know, it's...
The framework demands that we seek the least life-destroying path, but in a crisis, the procedural burden of the dashboard itself becomes a life-destroying force. The text argues that indicators should not control life, but help life recognize where it is being harmed. I just worry that by prescribing such an intricate, unyielding apparatus, the author has inadvertently created a new language of bureaucratic control.
Well, I completely disagree on that point, and here's why. You are ignoring the explicit flexibility built into the framework that we touched on earlier.
The minimum dashboard?
Exactly. The minimum dashboard is specifically designed for rapid screening in situations exactly like the one you're describing. It distills the 10 domains down to the most critical vectors: obvious life disablement, exclusion, or irreversible ecological risk.
It streamlines it.
Right. It doesn't demand a 10-year longitudinal study before you build emergency tents. It just demands that you don't put those tents on top of a sacred burial ground or a fragile aquifer without checking first. It forces a pause, not a full stop.
I will concede that the minimum dashboard is a vital inclusion. Honestly, it might be the only way this framework survives contact with reality. But let's look at the fine print there. Even the minimum dashboard demands what the text calls distributional visibility.
Meaning tracking the demographics?
Right. You can't just say, we housed 500 people. You have to show who was housed, who was excluded, and who bore the burden, broken down by race, class, gender, and migration status.
Which is essential data if you want to ensure you aren't just housing the privileged and abandoning the marginalized.
It is absolutely essential data. I completely agree. But gathering and validating that demographic data in real time during an acute crisis is incredibly difficult logistically. I think my overarching concern is that Dr. Saheli has diagnosed the disease of single-score technocracy flawlessly. The critique of GDP and aggregate scoring is just masterful.
It really is.
But the prescribed cure relies on a level of institutional enlightenment, funding, and community capacity that we just have not yet achieved anywhere in the world.
Perhaps the dashboard is the tool that helps us achieve that capacity. We don't wait to be enlightened before we change our metrics. We change our metrics to force the enlightenment. To cure the life blindness of our institutions, we fundamentally must change what we count.
It's a huge paradigm shift.
It is. We cannot keep relying on a system where aggregate progress on paper hides targeted violence on the ground. The Life Coherence Dashboard, with its absolute red lines, its distribution metrics, and its uncompromising insistence on honoring narrative, lived experiences, acts as a vital mirror. It forces us to see the full spectrum of what it means to be alive, and more importantly, it forces us to see when our systems are failing to support that life.
And while I respect that vision deeply, I maintain that a framework demanding simultaneous tracking of ecological viability, psychosocial security, and cultural continuity without ever allowing for mathematical commensurability or prioritization may simply be too fragile to survive the brutal, fast-paced pressures of actual governance.
You really think it'll just gridlock?
I do. We run the massive risk of creating a perfect evaluative system that is entirely paralyzed by its own parameters.
Well, yet, despite our differing views on its administrative viability and the very real risk of gridlock, I think we both clearly converge on one profound truth highlighted by this paper.
Which is?
The absolute danger of treating non-substitutable losses as compensable economic data points.
Oh, completely agreed. The idea that you can offset the extinction of a species or the erasure of an entire language by simply pointing to a localized increase in corporate revenue is a moral failure. The paper is absolutely correct that some things simply cannot be bought, traded, or averaged away.
It is the ongoing challenge of translating human and planetary flourishing into actual functional policy. For those of you listening, I highly suggest looking deeper into the source material. Specifically, read the worked examples of the Water Commons and the forest displacement case in the appendices.
Yeah, they're fantastic case studies.
They really are. Seeing how these specific indicators, signal, threshold, distribution, narrative, and repair perform under pressure gives a lot of weight to both sides of today's discussion.
It really does. It forces you to ask what you would do if you were the one holding the pen and making the final call.
Exactly. Because at the end of the day, we have to decide how we want to fly. Do we want to keep staring at that single flight score dial, pretending the engine isn't on fire just because the math averages out? Or are we willing to face the complex, sometimes overwhelming reality of a dashboard that actually tells us the truth about the plane we are in? We'll leave it to you to decide.